See Rome Vault Podcast, episode number 413, Monday, November 1st, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. What you got here is mostly a very long and very loosely structured conversation between me and Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator, and also the co-host of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast, which is a podcast about James Joyce that he does with his wife. But to start us off, here's the conclusion of my conversation with James Polis of The American Mind and also the Claremont Review of Books. And he's also the author of a book called Human, Forever, The Digital Politics of Spiritual War, which he is publishing on the Bitcoin blockchain. After that, Dermot and I will talk about, at first, cyclical history, you know, patterns, cyclical patterns in history, and some of the early figures who have described those patterns. Well, maybe not so early, I mean, some of them from the 20th century. And near the end, we'll talk a little bit about the whole Strauss and Howe fourth-turning, you know, generational theory of history. But first, the conclusion of my conversation with James Polis, which started in See Rome podcast episode number 576, Cyborg Vivarium. If you haven't heard that podcast, this bit with, I mean, you're really jumping into the deep end, catching the very end here with James Polis. But in any event, here we go.
Ordinary people just like recognize that this, you know, Bitcoin and other technologies controlling databases and stuff, it might seem complicated. It might seem like out of their comfort zone. It's really not that difficult. You don't have to become like a super science expert. You don't have to convert to autism in order to understand how these things work. You can do it. You can participate right now. And if enough people start doing that, then, you know, we're not going to be facing this kind of reduction to closet arrangers and, you know, to just complete slaves, the mercy of these AIs that we don't understand. We will direct technological energy toward toward protecting and reinforcing ourselves, our lineage. We will continue to think of having babies as something that is good. You know, people are worried about bringing kids into the world because they don't know what to tell them. They don't want them to turn into monsters. And they don't know how to control the technology. So of course you're not going to want to have kids under those circumstances. But if you just start right now, I mean, it's like, you know, it really is like working out. It really is like, regardless of where your fitness level is, if you just start right now getting used to this stuff, habits can be formed, the body responds, the body and the soul work together. And we can do this. We can ensure that we remain human forever, that it is doable. People are doing it right now. The generational memory that we need to ensure that generations coming of age with no memory of life before the smartphone still recognize that being human is good and that they're going to be human and that's good enough for us. That's a gift. Those of us who have kids who are that age, like now is the time to start making these arguments and doing the thing. That's why, you know, I've got a kid who falls into that category just about. You know, people of my generation, a lot of them are busy doing other things or struggling to make sense of what to do. So I felt a calling. I had the opportunity to write this book. I got it out, I think in time, hopefully. and I'm, you know, I'm grateful to be able to present it.
I look forward to reading it. But you know, what does adopting Bitcoin and crypto generally do in terms of the whole process of human beings being displaced from the job market? I mean,
yes, you know,
if you use crypto instead of dollars, you still need to make a living somehow.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think one thing that I would say is that our financial elite has basically admitted that the system that they've created is broken and unsustainable. They're not out there saying like, hey, everyone calm down. Like, you know, if you just stop electing angry populists, like we will just resume business as normal. Joe Biden ran explicitly on a platform of resuming business as normal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are we even into year one? Like we're in this time warp and it's just obvious that there is not going to be business as normal, period. We're not going back to the way it was. The petrodollar is going away. The dollar is the world's reserve currency is going away. The value of the dollar is going away. I mean, you talk about UBI, that's basically universal debt service. That's not going to work. So, you know, a big part of the Great Reset, I read the, you know, I read the paper from the BlackRock people, the top BlackRock people in Europe, 2019. They said, look, COVID, you know, we need to take this opportunity to create a true financial union in Europe, because if that doesn't happen, then the European economy is going to crumble and it's not going to get fixed. They want a financial union in Europe on a social credit basis. They want to reboot the US economy on a social credit basis, roll people off the dollar onto Fed points. Because they are recognizing that, you know, since 2008, they've tried all these different tricks to get back to normal and there ain't going to be no normal. So any way you slice it, we are facing a situation where the financial ground on which people stand is not stable. And so we're going to be switching over to something. And the only question is what you're going to switch over to.
Well, what you're going to switch over to and, you know, what you're going to do all day.
Yeah, what are you going to do? And so, you know, religious jobs are going to become more important, more significant, and better rewarded. Whether it's monastery stuff or priestly stuff, even just at the lay level, that's going to become more important. Just jobs, you know, people need their memories to be preserved, and they need to be reminded, you know, in the face of all this technology, that human memory is special. It is different from technological memory. And without having a chain of trust through our identities, we are going to completely lose contact with our past and even our very recent past. And if our, you know, we face very dedicated folks out there who think that the only hope for their sort of system to continue is to basically just erase our memories, just cause us to forget everything that happened before. Oh, that was ancient hatreds. That was all just racism and oppression, just bad stuff. You know, those people were unlike you. Thomas Jefferson was like an alien, like an evil alien, like don't care about, don't remember. Knowledge not worth knowing. Junk it all. We're starting over. And that is, you know, it is understandable in the sense that the people in charge realize that if they want to stay in charge, they have to refound the West, and they're trying to refound the world on a new footing that is viable in the digital age. That's what their offer is. And I think, you know, the offer from the rest of us has to be different and has to be compelling. And a lot of that is going to involve, you know, doing jobs, not because it's your calling or your passion, or, you know, deep inside your spirit lurks some ultimate vision of who you really are. And your job is to sort of like go through life trying to find a career that perfectly aligns with your true spirit. Like, that is a way of thinking that I don't think is going to survive. I think what is going to survive is people are going to realize that if human beings do not labor, if we do not do work, if we do not work with and for each other day in and day out, then we become insane, depressed, weak. And we're not going to make it if we sink to that level.
So we need to work with and for one another.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciated your taking the time, and I really enjoyed listening to you.
Thanks so much. A real pleasure.
Let me keep you on the line for just a second. Do you have time to answer that question that I forwarded to you?
I sure do.
Okay. So let me read it. Let's see. This will be behind the paywall. So Sean writes, what a great read. This was an excellent survey of the various issues looming across the battlefield. I'll be looking forward to this interview. If I had one question, it would be something like this. If we follow the drives of Silicon Valley through to conclusion and assume the singularity and godlike AGI or artificial general intelligence or computational ability, do larger quantities of intelligence or sensory input possess their own quality? Or does an amoeba, worm, or human know innately all that can be known about the absurdity of existence and non-existence? AGI will soon know physics better than anyone alive, but can it see under the feet of the bottom turtle? Or is it stuck here with the rest of us just to see the turtles further down? And if digital life is unable to see below the turtles, is the Butlerian jihad the right answer? The Butlerian jihad being the jihad against technology.
Right. So this is a very good question. As I hinted earlier, I don't think we're going to get to godlike AI anytime soon, or perhaps ever. you know, people, oh, Bitcoin is energy inefficient. And I'm like, have you considered China's energy consumption? Have you considered the petrodollar's energy consumption? But really, the energy consumption that it would take to support the, you know, the quote unquote life of this kind of super intelligent AI would be, I think, more than the entire output of the world right now. So, you know, if that's really going to come to being, we're going to have to first develop a source and use of energy that really just transcends everything that has ever happened before. And there's no talk of that. You know, even people who are like, we have 10 years before the Earth is incinerated. No talk about EMPing China. No talk about creating, you know, even nuclear, sort of like a nuclear power, a Manhattan Project for nuclear power. How's that for like a mind twister?
Useful Manhattan Project.
Right. This is not even on the table, not even being discussed, not even by Large Hadron Collider people. So I'm bearish on AGI at that level. But I will say this, it is already the case that we are building computer systems which are powerful enough and integrated enough into human life that we would want them to share our religion, basically. And I think when you look at the various civilization states in the world that are large enough and powerful enough to make good on the fact that they are the custodians or the inheritors of a religious and civilizational tradition, you know, Israel, Russia, India, China, the US, the European case is an interesting one. It's a little more complicated there. Countries like that are working just as hard as they can to hustle their butts to a place where they figure out how to use the deepest religious and civilizational resources that are unique to their country, to their civilization state, in the service of making sure that the bots serve us and not the other way around. China is doing this, you know, they, for all the talk of communism, there's a certain kind of communism going on there, of course. The real action is in figuring out how to make the bots Taoist. That is kind of their plan for making sure that their social credit system does what they want it to do. You know, Russia's response to the digital age was to build a gigantic new military cathedral. You know, I think that's a pretty definitive statement about where like the Russian statecraft is at right now. And in the US, you got, you know, the elites going like, well, we just need to abandon sort of John Lennon's like squishy fantasy thing and adopt woke religion and make it the official religion of the regime so that we can catechize the bots that way. And so I think one way or another, like there's going to be a lot of catechesis with regard to digital entities. And rather than sort of sitting back and going like, it will be interesting to discover what religion they decide for themselves that they like, we don't want that. Well, we want to tell
that's
them.
That's not going to be the problem. The problem,
and we want to help
even
them
with
understand.
The Butlerian Jihad, where, you know, and this is from the Dune universe, where in the distant past, there are no machines, there are no computers, there's no information technology in the universe of Dune, and they've trained human minds to do all of those tasks with all of these specialized castes of people. And the reason they did it is they had to fight this war against technology, you know, 1,000 years ago or several thousand years ago, but it wasn't AGI that they were fighting. They were fighting artificial intelligence in the service of malevolent humans who were bent on using it to enslave other humans. So it was never a
Terminator. There's always a human
situation
at the top of the stack. I think exactly. That's right. And I will also say this, like, I think we are in the middle of a world war right now. I think it's a digital war. And that is why we're not seeing like tanks and aircraft carriers being sunk. And we're seeing other weird stuff going on, you know, various ships, ports, oil refineries, things just randomly blowing up, gigantic explosions with no explanation. Of course, you know, there's huge intelligence warfare going on right now. Lots of stuff behind the scenes, lots of like government hacking, state-sponsored hacking, all kinds of things like this. And so the whole point of digital war is that you no longer have to fire any shots. And so if we're really going to find ourselves in a military conflict with, you know, with digital technology itself, it is going to be one that is much more like a mental war than it is going to be like a physical war, I think. So keep your minds and your hearts sharp. Remember who you are. And, you know, if we just accept our humanity and proudly defend it, we should be okay.
Excellent. Before I let you go, if I could, I'd like to ask you for a couple favors.
Yeah.
One is that when I put this podcast up, it'll probably go up tomorrow. Let me send you the link and have you share it around in whatever fashion you think best. And the second being, you know, a lot of authors, I have not been putting out the free podcast very often over the last couple of years. I have a behind the paywall podcast, which has to get, you know, my best and first energy. But it's the free podcast that brings in, you know, the new listeners for the paid stuff.
Sure.
So I've resolved to get back to, you know, doing the free podcasting, and the place where I fall down as a podcaster these days is on the producer side, you know, just reaching out, making connections with people, getting them to come on the show. And I know as an editor of an online magazine, you're probably in touch with a lot of people who would be good guests for this venue. So, all right, that last little bit there, you know, clearly James and I had stopped talking about, you know, the content of the podcast. And it was just a little bit of, you know, glad handing and what's the word I'm looking for? I suppose, you know, the value neutral term is networking or whatever. For me, I mean, being a podcaster, really, there's many hats or many job roles. The sitting here talking into a microphone, that's one. Talking to somebody else, you know, and structuring a conversation as an interview, that's a different role, really. And then there's the editing that, you know, successful podcasters have somebody else to do the editing. And then there's the producer's role. And the producer is the person who sends out that initial email. Hey, there's a podcast that exists. It's called the C-Realm Podcast. It has these attractive qualities that you should pay attention to and, you know, weigh carefully whether or not you want to pass up the opportunity to appear on this very prestigious, if not widely listened to, podcast. And that's the role where I have really fallen down in recent years. And I could give you a reason why, but it would be an excuse. But here's the thing. Lots of people think they're doing me a favor when they tell me, hey, you should have so-and-so on the podcast. They're great. Here's a link to something by them. Send that email to so-and-so instead of sending it to me. Say, hey, I know this podcast. The host is really good at what he does, but he's really kind of a half-assed producer, and he doesn't reach out to guests as nearly as much as he should. I think you should check out his show. Here's a link to an episode that I think really resonates with your area of interest. If you could make those sorts of connections for me, that would not only help me out a bunch, but improve the quality of the podcast according to your criteria. Win-win, right? There is that request. It is not a burden upon you. There is no guilt. There is no obligation involved. But if you would like to help shape the direction of the podcast and not necessarily hear the Vault podcast, I'm talking the main podcast, you know, build the profile of the main podcast, The Big Room, that would be awesome. All right, now, Dermot O'Connor. I'm sure you recognize his name and voice, but Dermot is somebody that I met in 2013, I think, in Portland, Oregon, at a couchsurfing tour event. And I think I had heard from him and corresponded with him before that, but as so often happens, a person becomes real when I speak to them for the first time, either, you know, telephonically or in person, face to face. And, you know, Dermot has got accomplishments. he's got a list of stuff that he's done that I could use to introduce him. But I think that it's best just to think of him as a smart guy who, you know, while he's got access to the same internet everybody else does, he still reads books, which makes him interesting. And he's got that lovely accent. So here's Dermot.
As long as I don't end up like that lawyer in Texas who came across with a cat, and I'm not a cat. You know, that was the greatest moment of 2020.
I missed it.
Oh, God, it'll be on YouTube. Yeah, you'll find it. Poor guy. It was like a deposition or something with the judge. And he comes in on Zoom and he's got like the big whiskers and cat ears. And he's just like, I don't know how to get this off. This is some good old boy, you know. I am not a cat.
My kid set this up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. worse things have happened to people with computers. Remember years ago, there was a priest, he started some slideshow for the church ladies and all this gay porn came up. And I think people were just relieved he was into grown dudes. You know, things have gotten so far that it's, that wasn't kids, you know. So everyone forgave him and they all said it was just very embarrassing. And
kind of makes you wonder if some of these accidental revelations aren't on purpose, like, you know, putting the cat nose and whiskers over your digital image, claiming you don't know how to get rid of it. I mean, it's certainly endearing, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. He can't be evil.
Yeah. I mean, he likes cats. All righty. I have a fresh, clean page and yet another notebook. I'm such a holdover. I mean, I go through a lot of these. These are the... College ruled. Yeah. And I don't know what this binding is called, but, you know, this tape binding and then a thick cardboard cover. I just love these things. I accumulate a lot of them. Today is the 30th of October, so Devil's Night. You know about Devil's Night?
In my hometown in Arklow, in Ireland, it's unusual. It has a custom called Banging Night. That's when the kids would go around banging on people's doors and running away. And sometimes they would put firecrackers through the doors. And there's only one other town in Ireland that does it. And it's on the other side of the country. I forget which town, Ballina or somewhere like that. And no idea why these two towns have this one peculiar local custom. So somebody started some mischief decades ago and it's stuck. And I don't know if the kids still do it or not, but it's kind of that nerve-wracking, you know, you're like trying to watch TV and then boom, boom, boom. So, yeah.
Well, that's definitely a very mild version of Devil's Night. You know, Devil's Night is the night for malicious mischief.
Yeah, burning houses down to the ground. Such.
If you're in Detroit, yeah. So speaking of Ireland, you are quite likely moving there in the near future.
Yeah, fairly solid now. We'll be able to stay in this house until the end of January in Portland, Oregon. And my landlady, she has to sell for medical reasons. I won't go into like the details, but it's very serious. So she needs a lot of money. And the only way she can get it, and she just can't pay the mortgage and pay healthcare on top of it. So she loses her house. And
very American story.
I lose my residence. So, you know, we were hoping to stay until 2023 and get out before the next presidential election cycle.
But you know, the next election cycle basically starts now. So
yeah, it does. It's going to be gearing up, but we certainly wouldn't want to be here for the actual election year proper. And I'd rather actually be home for our next election, which is going to be really enjoyable. But yeah, so it's just dialed us forward a bit. And I'm so lucky because my sister, she lived in America too for many years, and she was having the same problem. So she and her American husband, they sold their house and they got out from under it, and they had enough money left over to pay off the mortgage, get out of debt, and buy a house in Ireland. And 4-bedroom house with a little cabin out the back. So we'd be staying with her probably for about a year. Tight quarters, even with the bedroom count. But, you know, at least we can spread out a bit. And my mum and dad have a house up the street as well. So we'll have a little bit of breathing room. And Kelly, my wife, she's American, but she does a blog. We collaborate on it. It's a James Joyce blog and podcast called bloomsandbarnacles.com. And so obviously for a James Joyce aficionado like her, moving to Ireland is like a Muslim going to Mecca. I mean, there's no, it really is. It's just ground zero. She's going to be able to do interviews with people. And like, it's a real shame because we have been invited to speak at an Irish festival in Seattle in March, but I don't think we're going to be able to make that now. Unless somebody offers us like free accommodation for a couple of months here. But but anyway, we have like already a lot of contacts in Ireland. So then the problem would be just trying to find a place to live. Same old, you know, like either rent a place somewhere that's not too expensive or stay with my sister until we can save money for a down payment. And, like, the dream is to get like a half an acre to an acre, you know, not too rural and, you know, close enough, walking distance to a town. That's the general gist of where we were trying to settle. So, and then we can just take it easy and not have to worry about paying rent or a mortgage every month. That's what my sister said, not having to pay a mortgage or rent. And she's able to save most of the money she makes. And it's not like a utopia even at that, but at least she's able to, you know, not have to give $7,000 every month or whatever it is to a bank. And I said, no wonder people are cracking. You know, you just can't, nobody can live like that under that stress for forever. Her and her husband are like a different couple ever since they got out from under it. So,
Well, I could easily talk about people cracking and, you know, stressful topics, but let me steer it to the lighter side for a sec.
Yes.
I mentioned this in email to you, but, you know, for the benefit of the listeners, my father is passed, and he was an only child, and his parents have passed. So, yeah, and I know that his mother was born in Ireland and came to the U.S. by herself at the age of 16. Mm-hmm. But I don't know anything else, you know, I didn't know anything else about my father's side of the family, and there was nobody left to ask. I mean, that side of the family has died off. But, and I joined Ancestry.com a few years ago, and I did the DNA test and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And mostly what I found out on Ancestry was stuff about my mother's side of the family, which is much better documented, and it's a much bigger, you know, I have lots of living relatives who have done their own genealogical research. So I already had an embarrassment of riches on that side. But a few months ago, just out of the blue, somebody contacted me through Ancestry, who, you know, is a pretty close relative. And she actually knew my father and my grandparents, and she knows that side of the family, and she knows where they're from in Ireland. She's yeah. been there. She's met the relatives on that side. And she actually lives pretty close to what used to be called the, I can't even remember the name of the bridge now. New York has this thing where they rename bridges all the time after, you know, fairly recent politicians.
Yep.
So this bridge, which is north of the Hudson Bridge, or north of the George Washington Bridge, actually, and costs $5 to cross instead of 15, like the GW. There's a town there on the New Jersey side, and she lives there. And so I pass through there all the time when I go down to see my kids. But the place where my Irish family is located is in a town which, to my American eyes, looks like Coot Hill, but that's not how it's pronounced, I'm told. Do you know the place?
No.
I understand it's more like Cotill, but it is northeast of the place you told me where you'll be living.
Okay.
About 90 minutes. And it's pretty far north. You know, the Irish border is not a straight line. Right. And it's, you know, there are places in Northern Ireland which are further south than this place. But it is in Ireland proper.
So it sounds to me, if you have one Irish grandparent, then you should be entitled to Irish citizenship.
Actually, I have, in terms of grandparents, I just have the one. But her husband, you know, who she married when she got to the U.S., was first generation American, and his parents were from Ireland. And then on my mother's side, we're mostly Irish, except for my mother's father's father, who was British. Mm-hmm. And he actually born in the UK and moved somehow to Berryville, Arkansas.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So now for the grim. There is a whole genre of YouTube videos of people just driving around, mostly driving, sometimes walking or riding bikes around Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and just not even saying anything, just documenting what has become of, you know, what's happening on the streets. There's trash everywhere, homeless encampments, you know, encampments is even too organized a notion, just evidence of homeless living in public spaces and trashing everything they touch just all over the place. And I've seen such, you know, documentaries, if you want to call them that, about Portland. What's your on the ground view of that?
You wouldn't notice here, like we're in Northeast Portland, which traditionally was not one of the wealthier parts, but there's a couple of guys who live up on the street. They're fine. You'd really have to go downtown and toward the freeway system to begin to see the tent encampments. They're not anywhere near as bad as San Francisco. Like, I was shocked when I was in San Francisco a few years ago, about 2-3 years ago. It was just dystopian. I don't know how people can stand it. It was bad enough when I was there in 06, 07. And it's a lot worse than that. And it's getting worse. And, you know, I remember one woman, like, clearly mentally ill, like, just rocking back and forward, like, eyes just gone. And you have people like that. You have people that are on just drugs, people that are dropping out. It's the spectrum. And you can, like, I watched a YouTuber called German in Venice, and he's down in Venice Beach, probably seen some of his stuff. And yeah, like the stuff he was showing. I had heard from my sister that her friend said that there are stretches of the freeways in LA where you have to roll your window up because the smell of human waste is so strong from the tents. People have to crap. And the parts where the litter is like leaking onto the side of the freeway, it sounds like, you know, horrific. And I think the way things are going, it'll only get worse. You know, and you wonder what the various tipping points are. But I'm just so glad that where we are, at least right now in this bubble, we're okay. And I mean, in Ireland, they talk about the homeless crisis, and it's nothing. Like, it's compared to what's here, it's just nothing. So again, my wife is so delighted to be moving to a country where people talk about the homeless crisis, and it's like maybe 1% of the problem here.
So it's cold and wet here today, and the cat doesn't like it outside, but she's going to forget that it's cold and wet here in about 20 minutes and has to go back out again. All righty. Yeah, my cat is 16, three-legged. She's been an indoor-outdoor cat most of her life. She spent the last 3 years here just being strictly indoor, and I knew that, you know, she'd be happier if she had some outdoor experience, even though there are cars, there are dogs, there are other dangers.
Yeah.
But, you know, at this point, she's 16, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I have two very old cats. I won't move the camera. I'm afraid it'll tip over. But the two very old cats on the bed right now, 18 and 19, we think their ages are. Mm-hmm. So I have to leave them behind. They'll go back to their original owner, who hopefully will take good care of them. But they're too old to take with us. Like, can't take them.
You can't put them in the hold of an airplane. And, yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, I think the one of them has hypertension, and she's got stage three. Both of them are stage three or stage four renal, and it's like, no, they would die in the plane. It's no way to go. So we have to suck it up and say goodbye. And they might pass on before we leave. You know, I if they're going to go like within the first few weeks of 2021, I'd rather it be with us. You know?
Right.
But yeah, it's horrible. But we're taking the two younger ones with us.
So right now, my cat has stage three annoying. Go away. No, you can't sit up here. Go on. She basically wants to be planted up here on the desk between me and the camera. That's not going to fly.
Yeah.
She'll take a nap here in a minute. All righty. So I asked you what you were reading.
Yes.
And you mentioned, I think, Spengler.
Yeah, I went through Spengler. I've been meaning to. I bought all the books about the cyclical, historian analyses. Toynbee. I've read Toynbee before. He's really good. It's really interesting when you read these people because it's a form of history that used to be like done at a very high level, and by people who really knew, like astonishing breadth of knowledge these people had. Spartacus Spengler had to skip, as he's talking about like various ancient Greek poets and things. And I've never heard these people, like, oh my God, you know, he's like, okay, yeah, blah, 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 blah. It means nothing to me. So I have to get back to when I can find like a page where it's like, right now I know what he's talking about again. And it's not just names. And, you know, one thing I always say is like, it's clearly clear the people who lived in the past were doing serious things and they weren't binging Netflix shows.
Right.
Because to do this level of work, the amount of reading must have been and knowledge. And I just don't think many people have it. Even the professionals, I think they tend to specialize. So this kind of encyclopedic overview is kind of missing from a lot of people. Or if we have those kind of people now, they tend to be amateurs, like Jared Diamond. It's very problematic. So if you go back to somebody like Toynbee or Spengler or Petirim Sorokin is the guy I'm reading right now.
I was going to ask you about him because I'd never heard of him before. So I looked him up on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. I was just devastating or, you know, trashing Wikipedia on a segment of the main C-Rail podcast. But
yeah.
I'd never heard of the guy before, but he was born in Russia and I think had to flee for political reasons and ended up teaching here in the US and is basically the founder of sociology.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. He's one of these people most people have never heard of. And I forget how I stumbled over his name. It was one of those things, you know, with the whole like labyrinth of all the sites you read. But the book that I have to confess, I haven't gotten to his part of the book yet where he expounds his theory. So the first chunk of the book is him. It's amazing. He goes through all of the previous people who have their theories of rise and fall of civilizations and their models and how they break it down. And so he does a really nice like a summary of Spengler in there that actually is easier to comprehend than Spengler himself. And not that Spengler is deliberately incomprehensible. It's just it's really nice when somebody like John Michael Greer or Sorokin goes, right, here's what he said, doink. And and Toynbee as well, you know, and I think there's a couple of an abridged version of Toynbee, there's an abridged version of Spengler. Those are the ones I recommend reading because they did their big multi-volumes. It's like, you know, we have jobs and things. And The abridged will give you more than enough of an idea of what their whole point is. And, you know, again, it's how you stage it. Like these people would, you know, look at the civilization and stages and see the patterns. And it's fascinating when you see how the different writers break it down, you know, with their own point of view. They tend to overlap or with a Venn diagram. You know, it's just it's not exactly a circle, but, you know, they would all have some commonality. And of course, the big one is the Mukaddimah, which I haven't read. It's packed. It's going to be going back to Ireland with me. That's written by the 14th century Tunisian Ibn Khaldun, which I think people regard as the original book. Khaldun came up with the idea of cyclical history when because in the part of the world he was in, he had examples. Like you could see these different cultures rising and falling, and he said that the primitive groups on the outside of a civilization had what he called, and I probably will mispronounce the Arabic word, azabiyah, which translates into English as social cohesion.
Right.
And social cohesion would be reinvented. That concept would be invented by the West sometime in the 1800s. So again, we have a Muslim who is like centuries ahead of people in the West. And he said, these people have social cohesion. The advanced cultures that are sedentary living in cities, they become degenerate, and, you know, with not throwing shade on them, but people become very decadent. They stop, you know, their martial training. They become divided against one another. Everyone's arguing about things until the day comes when we see like a cloud on the horizon and all these fellas are coming at you, you know, on horseback or camels or whatever. And they topple the old, you know, degenerates, and in they come. They have their golden age, and then they become decadent, decline, and the cycle just repeats over and over and over again. And so the various theorists, they all come up with this. Now, Spengler has a dodgy reputation. I think people tend to associate him with the Nazis. So I was reading the book with that in mind, I'm like, there is nothing in this man's work that you could say makes him a Nazi. Like, it's just astonishing. Like, I've actually made marginalia on it. Like, how the fuck could anybody think Oswald Spengler was a Nazi? Now, he didn't like democracy. He was more like H.L. Mencken. I think he had the viewpoint that any democracy that you'd be, even if you begin with a pure, perfect democracy, it's not long before the wealthy find out how to buy it.
Yeah, it becomes an oligarchy.
And then a cacistocracy when you just have completely incompetent people running it. And then it collapses because of its own internal contradictions. So that was more of his contempt for democracy, just the fact that it would be practically impossible to maintain the damn thing, which I think the founding fathers in America kind of knew anyway. They probably thought, well, maybe we'll get 100 years out of it or whatever. And somebody else's problem, I'll be in a box. So
before you move on from there, there's a great quote that sums up what you're talking about. And I had to look it up. I was going to try to reproduce it from memory, but here I've looked it up. It's, hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. The quote from a post-apocalyptic novel by author G. Michael Hopf sums up a stunningly persuasive cyclical vision of history.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nicely simplified and condensed, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, I think Toynbee, if I remember now, it's been a while since I read him, but he said that a civilization comes together when you have a creative elite, like a small group of people who really know what they're doing, and they can pull it together. And then over the course of the civilization, they become senile and they become insular. And when you read that, it's like, yeah, the creative minority. And then you have from that to the senile elites. And you look at 1776 and there's a creative minority, and you look at 2020 Washington, D.C. and now you have like literally senile men fighting over the presidency. And you know, it's just, where's it going to go from here? Don't know. But the omens aren't very good. It's hard to be optimistic. So all I can tell you is, like, if so many people I've spoken to are trying to get out or figure something out, you know. I remember 2008 when Obama won, there was a sense of relief that, oh God, okay, sanity's been restored and, you know, things will get back on the road. And it was a delusion. And I think this time, however, like, people have, even the 2020, one of my neighbors up the street moved to Denmark, and he actually said to me, maybe a typical Portland like liberal type, he said, yeah, even with Biden being elected, I'm not optimistic at all. I think the next few years are just going to be horrible. I'm like, yeah. And it's kind of shocking to see just how low down the expectations have come in just a few years.
You're familiar with the let's go Biden shibboleth?
No,
let's go Brandon. So there was
nice.
Yeah. For those who don't know, and I'll just insert the clip, but there's a NASCAR racer, and I don't remember his name. I don't follow NASCAR, but he just scored a victory of some sort, or, you know, did something impressive, and he's being interviewed on live TV, and the interviewer, and while he's being interviewed, the crowd behind him is clearly chanting "fuck Joe Biden." And the interviewer tried to spin that and say, yeah, and the crowd's chanting, let's go Brandon. So Brandon is the name of the racer. So now let's go Brandon is the, it's a stand-in for fuck Joe Biden. And there was a Marine, a U.S. Marine, who stopped a robbery in progress, I think in Texas just recently. And the city gave him an award, like a plaque. And there's a picture of him accepting the plaque, and he's wearing a red MAGA hat and a blue t-shirt that says, let's go Brandon.
Oh, Jesus. Oh my God.
In fact, I'll use that as the cover art. I said something terribly clever on Twitter, and I'm not going to try to look it up, but something to the effect of, and I'm so modest there, you know, terribly clever. People are, you know, Joe Biden has these very low approval ratings right now, but he campaigned for president as an infrequently animated corpse, mm-hmm. and he's governing the same way. Isn't this what you wanted? This is what you voted for. Isn't this what you wanted?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm amazed for a man in his physical condition, he's doing so much. As you know, I mean, I know there's the whole thing about, is he senile or not? I'll tell you, my dad is, and I've watched him decline over the course, very painfully over the course of the last 10 years. And it just reminds me so much. And one of the red flags is he stops using personal pronouns. So he'll talk about that guy over there in that building, meaning the head of the Pentagon, you know, General Smith in the Pentagon or whatever. And dad would do that. And it's how he covers the fact he can't remember someone's name. And he would have an entire conversation with you, and then you think, oh, he's completely lucid. And then he would say, so I was talking to, what's her name the other day? Kara. And that's my sister, like his own daughter. And that's when I Aer Lingus.com booked the flight home, because this might be the last time that I'll ever really be able to talk to my dad. So watching Biden just doesn't make me angry, and it just makes me sad. I don't like Biden, but I don't like seeing somebody in that condition. And I don't like Trump either, by the way, because anyone thinks that. But no, it's just and the most stressful job probably in the world, you know, starting top 10. And it's draining, and it doesn't take much to have a sudden decline. Like a cognitive decline can be very quick because it's not linear.
Yeah.
Dad in 2020, dad went in for gallbladder surgery, and my mother's worked with dementia patients as well. And she said, we're not getting them back. If we do, his mind will be half gone. And it was like he went in and we couldn't visit him. So he was in the hospital by himself for 2 weeks, no visitors.
Is that an effect of the general anesthesia?
No, it was just being, if you take a person in cognitive decline and you isolate them for a couple of weeks, they're gone.
Yeah. When he came out of their familiar environment too.
Yeah, like before that, he was able to make tea, make sandwiches, feed himself. When he came out, he made a cup of tea, put a tomato in it. Like, and suddenly his mind rocketed back, and he was back in 1950 looking for his brothers and sisters, saying, where is everybody? So he had gone from being a man who sort of knew where he was to a man who had lost any remaining architecture of the preceding 20, 30 years, to where he'd sort of know who you are, to now it's like, you're a person who seems to be friendly to me, but I don't really know who you are. His own brother, my namesake Dermot, he referred to him as that man, and like, closest person he has in his entire life other than his immediate family. And you know, so yeah, I see that stuff, and for me, yeah, some of it can be a slip of the tongue, but there's too many of them. And you know, and again, good days and bad days, sometimes I watch videos of him and I go, he seems to really have it together this time. And then, but that's what dad was like too, you know?
Right. But remember the one-on-one debate with Bernie Sanders when they were the only two left in the Democratic primary contest?
Yeah,
he had a very good day that day.
Yeah.
He seemed really lucid for the whole time. And I remember people commenting on Twitter that, gosh, this is boring, you know, just waiting for his meds to wear off, that then it'll get interesting.
But
they didn't.
And you know, they are, like, there are meds that they can give, and Dad's had a bunch of them, but that they would be giving these guys oxygenated blood and you name it, like, they've got blood boys. This is like very high level stuff that they're doing. They're not mucking around with like $800 pharmaceuticals. They're giving these guys like high end, whatever the best they have, they're getting it. And for short term performance, you know, we just need 2 good hours to, you know, work out the sleep cycle. What's the sweet spot? But yeah, you won't be seeing them. And this aversion to answering direct questions, like, you know, there's been very little of that. Like from a hostile audience. Even George Bush did that. You know, I forget the lady, the old female journalist. She was a legend. She was in her 80s and she would give, God, she was great. Name? Yeah, I should remember. But she would just tear strips off them. There's nobody like that anymore.
No. Well, they wouldn't be invited back in. They'd never be called upon these days. Yeah. And yeah, these days the corporate news media is just so congenial to the, you know, the positions of power, because I think largely their legitimacy comes from the fact that they're granted access to the halls of power. It certainly doesn't come from the size of their audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, they're playing in God mode. And, you know, that again, when you play a game in God mode, it makes you very poorly equipped to deal with people who don't play in God mode, like, you know, the Chinese. I'm not into China bashing. Like, you know, I have friends who are tankies. They make very persuasive arguments. And our Russia bashing, they're just like other countries and they're trying to avoid ever being crushed again. Like 1990 in the Soviet Union, they have painful memories. Fair enough. They're like Putin and Xi Jinping are clearly operating on a different level. And they have been for a while. And I read a lot of like Russian military bloggers, few anyway, and it's fascinating to read like from the other side of the aisle, like, you know, about how they regard America's military prowess or not, and all the new fighter planes and hypersonic missiles and everything. Like and yet you have people in America trying to stir up a Cold War. It's like, God almighty.
Well, it's a complicated situation. The last two episodes of this podcast were me laying out the, you know, the complicated geopolitical web around China, Taiwan, South Korea, Vietnam, Japan, and Australia, and of course the United States.
Yep.
There was a belief among the Foreign Service here in the U.S. that if China liberalized economically, that political liberalization would follow. And that seemed to be playing out until Xi Jinping secured the top slot. And he's become very authoritarian. And China is going full steam ahead toward, like, China and the United States are in an arms race. It's to some degree, you know, it's a conventional arms race and a nuclear arms race, but mostly it's an AI arms race. Mm. And China is very coordinated. You know, the Chinese Communist Party demands absolute obedience from the heads of industry. And that's just not the case here in the US. So the Chinese AI agenda is very centrally organized and it's very clear. Whereas in the US, it's just the various big tech companies each pursuing their own projects, largely in competition with one another, but also in competition with their Chinese counterparts. But it's not a unified approach. And it's certainly not coordinated by the US government. And China has been, they've just demonstrated their eagerness to use artificial intelligence and ubiquitous surveillance for social control.
Right.
And, you know, they export that to all of their, you know, their authoritarian leaning trading partners, of which there are many, you know, because their Belt and Road Initiative has got them, you know, in close contact with people, you know, countries, the leaders of countries in Northern Africa and Central Europe, which don't have any long history of, you know, egalitarianism or democracy, and tend to be rather, you know, quick to go to authoritarian methods. But, you know, until recently, they haven't had the technical prowess or the money or, you know, really just the means in general to be an effective totalitarian, you know, to institute effective totalitarian regimes. I'm thinking more in Africa here. Certainly Eastern Europe had very effective police states. But, you know, China is, I hate the phrase, but taking it to a new level. And it's because of technology.
When I was in China in 1994, I was in Shenzhen for 4 weeks. It was an animation project, and I had an English coworker who was there with me. There was like a little stall at the bottom of the studio where we went down to buy some sweets and Coke or whatever. And because we couldn't speak Chinese, so the lady behind the counter pulls out an abacus and she moves the beads and she shows us the beads and we go like, we still don't have a clue.
Pretty beads.
And she goes and she rolls her eyes and just takes our money and gives us back the change.
And I'm sure she gave you the correct change.
She did, I'm sure. So fast forward 30 years and that same person will hold up a smartphone.
Yeah.
And I'll still do this. Like I, you know, you've just gone past me like into the future. And in the space of like just a couple of decades that happened.
Well, now the smartphone will speak to you in English. You know,
oh, okay. Yeah.
It'll be words that you just hear and respond to.
Right. So I don't even have a smartphone. So I'll be, give me the abacus. I'll have a go at that.
yeah. When I lived in Japan in the early 90s, like in the train stations, the guys at the booth selling tickets would be using abacuses still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were super quick at it. Just...
Oh, yes. It's very fast.
Yeah.
And there's a story in Richard Feynman's book, Surely You're Joking, about he gets into a mathematics competition with a Chinese man who has an abacus. And the Chinese man beats him for certain levels of calculation. But when the calculations get really complex into like higher level maths, he just can't keep up, like square roots and things like that. And and Feynman tells his wife, well, yeah, he doesn't really understand mathematics. He's just moving beads. The beads are telling him, it would be like us using a pocket calculator. You just, mm-hmm. you don't understand what's going on inside that machine.
But somebody who's trained on an abacus and has used it for years, you can take the abacus away and they can visualize manipulating the beads on the abacus and still do the same calculation. So at that point, it seems implausible to me to say that he doesn't really understand the mathematics.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. He's running an algorithm in his head, but you know, who's to say that's not what understanding mathematics is.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's philosophical argument.
We are free associating here and in what is to me a very entertaining way, but for an attempt at cohesion in this conversation, let's circle back to cyclical history. Does anything that we've been talking about really resonate with what you've been reading about cycles of history? Take a couple minutes to compose yourself if you need to. I can easily cut it out.
Okay. Like, you mean in what sense? Like current affairs, events, that kind of thing? Or
yeah. Well, you know, the contest of nations. You know, I think we're largely in agreement about the insufferability of, you know, the young woke crowd.
Yeah.
And. Yeah. You know, that's, I think, definitely emblematic of a cyclical progression. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't imagine somebody who lived through the Depression having the same cultural, you know, obsessions as the millennials. I think the Gen Z are largely, they're swinging to an opposite extreme from the millennials, you know, at least what I see of them through my kids and, you know, Colin over at the TV station, they tend to be kind of reactionary.
Yeah. That's worrying, you know, because again, the opposite of one bad idea is often another bad idea.
Exactly.
You know, you're just on a spectrum of bad. That's not good either. Like trying to think about like where we are, like, you know, one of the, you and I both got caught up in the whole collapse stuff back in the mid zeros.
Well, I have stuff to say about that. So yeah, keep
okay.
going.
I got into it because I lived in Pasadena and I was close to Caltech. And there were a bunch of public lectures down there. So I went to one given by David Goodstein, who was professor of physics or emeritus at that time. And he had written a book about peak oil in 2004. It's one of the first books. So you're in the Beckman Auditorium and it's huge, very impressive space. And here's this guy going through all the numbers about basically how we're probably fucked. And you walk out of that kind of stunned. That was actually the night of the third Kerry Bush debate. Remember that? I thought everybody else in the country is watching Bush and Kerry wasting their time. And this was a much, much more interesting use of my hour or two. And there were other peak oil geologists, Kenneth DeFay's book there. But there was another guy, I think, called Nathan Lewis. He did a talk called Powering the Planet. It might still be online. A lot of these were put up on their website. They might still be there. And I think Lewis's lecture said, I'm not even going to deal with peak oil. I'm going to ignore it. Because I don't think he thought it was going to be an issue. So let's just look at the amount of energy that's going to be required to power our civilization by. And I think the year was 2040 or 2050, which is coming around real quick now. And when he went through that hour, you still feel like, oh my God, like just take peak oil and just take, put it over here. And you still go, the amount of power that's going to be required to keep this thing going is so staggering. The number of nuclear plants that will be required. And all you get in the years since, and that was 2006, it's been 15 years ago. And all we've had since then are just like, bunkum. Like, it's no serious attempts to deal with, firstly, conservation. Stop using the goddamned energy. You know, if you're not going to build any new plants, let's stop squandering energy. And instead, we went the opposite. Bigger TVs, bigger everything, bigger, bigger, bigger. And
although, to be fair, you know, my big flat screen panel over here uses a lot less energy than the, you know, the cathode ray tube version okay, 20 years ago.
Yeah, fair enough.
No, it's much bigger and looks better, much better.
Somebody, oh no, I'm not, you're not taking away my flat monitors. That's not happening. like, for example, LED lights come in and people are like, oh, this is great. Our power supply will go down, we'll save energy. And people just began putting lights everywhere because they're so cheap. And, you know, now you can't see the sky, whatever little sky you could see before, you can't. Yeah, no, it's people, it's like the Jevons paradox. If you reduce the cost of something, the usage goes up. Mm-hmm. So all those nice people out there conserving energy are just lowering the market price so that it can be used by somebody else somewhere else. And the solution to that is like some sort of rationing or a state control of the price or caps on the amount you can use as an individual, things that nobody's going to want to do.
Well, state controls on the price is what's leading to rolling blackouts in China right now.
Yeah. 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 And that may be something they have to solve. And because they have limits, like they're going to be hitting their limits, or they are hitting their limits. They, you know, you grow at the other thing too, that I really clued me into the collapse narrative was I thought, and this is again, 2004 or 2005, I thought, well, what if there's like $1 trillion of barrels of oil sitting somewhere? They're going to find it. Peak oil's off the, you know, not an issue anymore, at least in our lifetimes. And then I saw Albert Bartlett's video lecture, Arithmetic, Population and Energy. And that's, I think, on YouTube still. And that's hour long. And that was just arithmetical progression of growth rates, logarithmic growth rates, exponential growth. And, you know, it's just laid out with mathematics. And he's a professor emeritus from Colorado University. I actually met some friends of his at one point. He died a few years ago. And I actually exchanged some emails with him.
I interviewed him twice.
Yeah, great. Oh, that's right. I remember that now. Yes. Very genteel man.
Although, I have to say, with Albert Bartlett, I mean, he's a very smart man. He definitely knows his math, but he got it completely wrong. You know, populations are, or reproduction anyway, you know, fertility rates are crashing in every place that has electricity, pretty much. Every place that has smartphones,
right?
Fertility rates are crashing. So I don't really have any patience or interest anymore for the whole population bomb. Oh, there's too many people. It's like, no, we're really facing the opposite problem, because in the contest of nations, you know, the nations that are thriving always have high birth rates. You know, the nations that fall below replacement level, they're also RANs. They're like the Japans of the world.
Well, the other issue isn't so much population, but as economic growth. You can forget about the population and just replace the world with 10 million Norwegians. If they keep growing their economy at 4% a year, they'll screw the place up pretty damn quick, even if they can cap the population. So you've got population growth or not, but we're still heading for about, 9.5 billion, I think, by 2050.
And yeah, I don't think we're going to get there.
I don't think so either, to be honest. Yeah. But if the economy, if the economic system is built on growth and it can grow or collapse, then it's going to collapse. And it's only a question of when and how much damage it wreaks before it does. So at which point we'll start the John Michael Greer process of entering the new dark age. But again, we're going to mention Greer before. Like, that's one of the voices then that kind of stood out around that time was Greer, because a lot of the narrative was veering into fast crash and did a lot of damage, because when fast crash didn't happen, people wanted to see those thunderdomes, you know, in every town, and they didn't get their goddamn thunderdomes, damn it.
And let me unpack that for people who might not get the reference. The third Mad Max film that starred Mel Gibson was Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And there was a town. I mean, Max is just this guy wandering the wasteland when somebody steals his vehicle, and he has to go into town to try to retrieve it. And the town is Bartertown, and they have electricity. And they have it because they have a methane refinery based on pig shit in the caverns below the city. And they have a very brutal system of law. And, you know, if you accuse somebody and there's no way to adjudicate, and they don't try too hard to adjudicate, then you fight them in the Thunderdome. And yeah, very exciting. I mean, that was their entertainment.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, and Greer said, no, there's not going to be a fast crash. You know, there'll be like punctuated points where bad things will happen and it'll feel like the end of the world. And then there'll be like a recovery that will last a few years. And since he wrote that, we've already lived through like at least one of those. And now we're living through another one.
My first interview with him was for his book, Apocalypse Not, where he was saying, yes, I acknowledge, you know, all the basis of the peak oil arguments, and no, it's not going to happen that quickly. That's not how history unfolds.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of that early fast crash stuff was boomer narcissism. Like that generation they were the chosen ones who were going to live through it and see it with their own eyes.
And our civilization can't possibly go on without us.
Yeah, guess what? So yeah, it put me in, it gave me like a better yardstick.
We love you, boomers, by the way.
Oh yeah, no, some of the best
I have a disproportionate number of boomers in this audience.
Look, some of the best people are boomers. And you know, I see that those, like, you know, you watch like some fucking music video from the 60s and 70s and go, God, these are the coolest people ever. Mm-hmm. And then I think, yeah, but how many of you pricks went on to vote for Reagan, you know? But I know a lot of you didn't, and you guys are okay. One of my posts online somewhere was when I read about, and I didn't know about these guys. They were the ones who broke into an FBI building and they stole a bunch of documents and released them to the press. And it ended up like exposing like a huge FBI spy ring that was spying on people. And I posted, these are some okay boomers. So yeah, yeah. That was, and what's her face? Oh, what was the musician? She tried to like spike Nixon with LSD. And she was, oh God, my memory. I'm so early in the day, I haven't had coffee yet. But there's people out there listening, I'm screaming the name into the speakers. But anyway, she's famous. And later in life, she parked her car by the road and she was reading poetry or something. And a cop came up and harassing her. So, what are you doing? And her reply was, I'm reading poetry, fuck off and leave me alone. And he arrested her. But anyway, I thought, this is the kind of protest we need. Not this like, no, hashtag, hashtag. It's like, no, get into the White House and put LSD in Nixon's coffee or whatever, you know.
Although I don't dose Joe Biden.
No, not Joe. Wait for Trump to come back in 2024 and maybe give him like a spirit quest. I mean, that's what he needs. Ayahuasca. There we go. Change with the times.
So on the topic of, you know, the articulators of the peak oil fast crash narrative, you know, where are they now? Most of them are still alive.
Yeah.
And like Matt Savinar, do you remember him?
I do. Well, yes.
So he's like a full-time astrologer, professional astrologer now. That's just what he does.
Yeah.
Doesn't have a thing to say about peak oil, but you know, I think about the people that I was associated with. James Howard Kunstler is, you know, he's just keeping a candle in the window for the fast collapse. Mm-hmm. He just hasn't relented on that.
Yeah.
Dmitry Orlov has moved to Russia, is hyper pro Putin. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually paid to get his behind the paywall glimpse, you know, on Patreon, and he's got this art form down of, he posts something and the first half of the post that is available to the general public is fairly sane. And then you click through to the behind the paywall portion and he's peddling conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Kind of nutty ones. But at the same time, you know, he's so hyper pro Putin and Russia is a petro state. Mm-hmm. You know, they get all their money by, you know, from oil and gas. And so he has done an exact 180 on the whole peak oil narrative and said, you know, advanced societies run on fossil fuels. There's no such thing as clean coal. There's no such thing as decarbonizing the economy. Wow. Solar is stupid. Wind is stupid. He's just, you know, completely flipped on that.
Wow.
I remember Kathy McMahon, the peak shrink. Remember her?
I don't know.
Well, I remember when I was really into peak oil, Doug Lane told me that, you know, the whole peak oil fast collapse was a right-wing reactionary narrative. And I rejected that analysis at the time. But I also remember Kathy McMahon saying that like her whole thing was people who heard about peak oil were getting really freaked out about it and overreacting to it. And in the process, getting diagnosed, you know, with some psychological malady by mental health professionals who had never heard of peak oil.
Right.
And, you know, her whole pitch was, look, you're not crazy. Well, some of the people were crazy.
Yeah.
But what she identified and what she told me about was that some of the people that she hears from are these hardcore right wingers who are hungry for collapse.
Yep.
And who were hungry for collapse so that they could punish the people, you know, that they thought didn't deserve to enjoy the power and the freedom that they enjoy in the modern age, particularly
yep.
women. And at the time, again, I was highly skeptical of Kathy McMahon. But now, man, I really see it. I mean, a lot of the former peak oil crowd has just yep. gone full on Red Tribe MAGA.
Yeah.
And Kathy yep. McMahon herself has, you know, receded into the background. I assume she's just still practicing, you know, psychotherapy quietly somewhere and not trying to be a public figure.
Yep.
But then there's John Michael Greer, who I don't follow his stuff as closely as I did when he was doing the Art Steward Report. And it's largely for me just because I don't understand his current schedule and I'm kind of behind, you know, there would be a lot of catch up for me to try to figure out what he's up to these days, but he seems to be very focused on, you know, esoteric practices, mm-hmm. Which, you know, it's great. I have an interest in that thing, you know, in like ritual magic and stuff, but in terms of, you know, talking about the big picture, I don't see that much from him anymore. And when I do, it's old stuff.
I think he's felt he said everything he wanted to say about it. And he's done a couple of like references to it. I asked him about it, and because of course I did the movie about peak oil, and he said, you should polish it up because it's coming back, you know, it won't be long now, you know, and we're seeing the energy. What's fascinating now is there's this energy crisis and no one's talking about resources or peak anything. It's like the word has been scrubbed, and I find it quite sinister. And it's this absolute reluctance to deal with the concept of like finite resources when it is being dealt with. Like I saw a left-wing YouTuber did a whole bit on the green corporate bullshit and how they're saying, you know, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. That's now become kind of a catchphrase on this from these uber rich Davos types. They're going to weaponize it because the narrative has been left to the right. And they are, as they always do, they'll take it, they'll take something that's real, and they'll come up with the wrong solution, one that salutes that suits them. So they talk about, you know, all this build back better crap. It's like makes your flesh crawl, half of this. The whole Greta Thunberg thing as well is very, very engineered. Nobody goes from zero to a trillion on the internet without like an absolute marketing push. There's a website called Wrong Kind of Green.
Yeah,
I forget if it's .com or .org, Corey Morningstar's site. The most depressing site. I think I may have mentioned them before. The most depressing site I've ever read, and I believe them. You know, depending on like what can you believe? It's like it just feels right. Like this thing is a $100 trillion effort to liberate pension funds into a green new deal, and it can't sustain like a modern electrical grid. It requires base. It requires like something that can be switched on or off, like a nuclear reactor or a fossil fuel plant. And migrating to something intermittent is very dangerous because then you've got intermittency and the whole grid can go down very quickly. So again, like dealing with, you know, we're just in a state of overshoot right now until things resolve in some way or form. But it's just this feeling. I watch like a lot of YouTube channels across the spectrum, like a lot of, I like sometimes the more right-wing money guys because a lot of them actually believe in capitalism, want it to work. They hate what's happening as much as anybody on the left, maybe more so sometimes.
What names come to mind in that genre?
Wealthion, Wealthion on YouTube. They used to work with Chris Martinson, another peak oiler, on Peak Prosperity, and then they kind of went off. But they seem to be very affable, very sane. That'll be the main one that I would recommend to begin with. I watch a lot of the gold bugs as well, just to see what they think that the metals are doing. But no, it's like, and there's a lot of guys just focus on China. Like, and I have some guys that are always like anti-China from an American point of view. I also have China stands, tankies, that are Daniel Dumbrell is one. He's very interesting because he's married.
I should tune into some China stands because I get plenty of the other side. So yeah. What's his name? Daniel
Dumbrell, Dumbrill. And he's actually in China. So he will, you know, be able to give like a on the ground account of what's happening in there. very much more so from a pro-Chinese point of view, because all we get in the West is just bash, bash, bash. So, Moon of Alabama is a website that does a lot of good coverage as well. And they had a post about a couple of weeks ago about the dark side of China, and they had aggregated all of the Western news stories about China. And what about the dark side of China's dot, 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 X, fill it in. And it's like, Jesus Christ, what about the dark side of China's candy industry? The dark side of China's this. And it's clearly an op. Like, you don't see this kind of monofocus on this two little dark side, and this just accidentally, you know, erupting all across all these American media channels. This is like Iraqi WMDs to me. It seems like we're going to accuse them of all kinds of crimes against humanity. I'm not saying for a second China's like a, you know, paradise or anything, but I could do the same thing with America, the dark side of America's pharmaceutical industry, the dark side of America. You know, you could do it with any country. It makes no sense.
Yeah. The dark side of America, though, is just as popular as the dark side of China. It doesn't need any boosting.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is also candy. I mean, there was a video of there's this an area of Philadelphia where junkies hang out, and I've seen so many people on YouTube reposting the same video of just, you know, it's like dashboard cam, somebody driving around this neighborhood, just, you know, filming the squalor and the despair and the human misery. And it's just, it is circulated far and wide. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, I know that exists. I know it does, but it's not the whole story of the United States.
Yes. I mean, yeah. Like, we have it here, like the amount of people in the Midwest who think that Portland is a burned ruins Hiroshima. Like, well, I'm going to be going up later and I'm going to walk up the main street of Hiroshima and get a really nice coffee and maybe a little fruit scone. So I'll be okay. Yeah. I'll hang out at the Irish pub. Maybe I'll get some fish and chips, you know, Hiroshima flavored fish and chips. They'll be fine. I'll be fine. Yeah, no, it's the news media does an amazing job of mind fucking people, and it's just unreal. Another writer too, and he's my to read pile. Jacques Ellul, he was a Christian socialist who wrote about propaganda, and probably much more worth reading than Orwell when it comes to propaganda. But one thing he said was that the educated person thinks they're not susceptible to propaganda when they are the most susceptible to propaganda, exactly, because they don't think that they can be fooled by propaganda.
But what's more, they are the primary targets for it.
And he said it has to be wall to wall. Like, the propaganda has to be completely, it has to entirely circle them so that there's no escape from the mirrors. It's always it's beaming the same lie at them all the time.
Like Sagar and Jetty and Crystal Ball, they often say that everybody they know in Washington, D.C. is always watching, you know, CNN, CNBC, or if they're on the other side, Fox. But nationwide, those networks, you know, their audiences are tiny compared to people watching YouTubers that you've never heard of.
Yeah, you know? I found out recently there was an attempt to Britain to launch a news network called GB News, which is going to be Fox News for Britain. And it's just ended in disaster. I think it's still going, but it's a joke, and lower production values than YouTube channels. And where's it going? GB News. Oh, yeah. So I found out that their viewing figures for some shows were zero, like zero. Well, there might have been two people out there watching at one point, but you must sure. And the BBC will be pulling in something like 30,000 viewers for the BBC News channel. And that shocked me, because that's BBC News. You think there's 30,000 people in a country of 70 million?
Well, Joe Rogan just had this big war with CNN, and the CNN, I want to call them VJs, but you know, the hosts of the various shows were snickering and, you know, talking about Joe Rogan as if he were some fringe figure. And yet his audience dwarfs theirs orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
In terms of their reach into the general public, it's nothing. It's irrelevant. They are fringe figures, but they have access to the halls of power. You know, powerful people will talk to CNN where they won't talk to Joe Rogan. Yeah. And the people who live in Washington, D.C. tune out the media that everybody else is watching, and they surround themselves. They create this insular environment with media that nobody else watches.
Right. Yeah. Like, newspaper sales in the UK have like just cratered. Like, the Daily Sun, I think, used to have like 10 million, and now it's down to like a few hundred thousand or 100,000. But in terms of like what Jacques Ellul was saying, I saw a left-wing, there's a YouTube channel, Novara Media on YouTube. They're very good. And they said that, you know, it's good that these horrible reactionary rags are, like, you know, declining. But if you look at it from the point of view of what Jack DeLille said, the whole point, Murdoch runs the Daily Sun because he has a loss, because he wants that ability to manipulate. All he needs is to have the Daily Sun on a shelf with the headline, Corbyn hates Jews. and then it's done its job.
Yeah.
Because Joe Sixpack walks by and goes, oh, that Corbyn guy, he hates the Jews. Done. He's wrecked. And then you a couple of papers mirror that, and then, you know, then it's the truth. We have created the truth. And a man who has spent his entire life fighting anti-Semites is an anti-Semite. He's been accused of being an anti-Semite by a paper that is itself anti-Semitic.
Working, I can well imagine Bernie Sanders being accused of anti-Semitism.
They tried. They did try. It didn't stick because he's too much like Larry David, you know. But they got him with the woman thing. You know, they'll find something. They'll always make up something, you know. He has a woman problem. And this is the use of identity policy. I wonder if they're getting back to collapse and cyclical stuff. Like, did this happen before? To what level is this situation unique? Is it the scale of it or the technology? And Mark Zuckerberg wants us all to live in the metaverse with fucking VR goggles.
Oh yeah, let's talk about Meta. You know, Google, what we think of as Google, which is a bunch of different companies and services, is really Alphabet. You know, Google is the search engine. So Facebook is trying to do a similar sort of rebranding where there's going to be a parent company of which Facebook is just one piece, because Facebook, in terms of usage and reach and revenue, is dwarfed by Instagram. And a lot more people are in contact daily with WhatsApp, like I am. I talk to Rose twice a day on WhatsApp, and I don't even have a Facebook account anymore. And so they're trying to rebrand their company and call it Meta, of which Facebook will be just a tiny piece. And Meta is, you know, a metaverse. You know, people who have seen or read the book Ready Player One understand, you know, the metaverse is the internet, but you have an avatar in the internet, and that's how you're interacting with people. And Facebook they've rolled out their own metaverse, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it is ham-fisted and clunky and stupid looking. And at the same time, all of these different crypto companies are rolling out their metaverses, and these are going to be play to earn games. So in addition to looking better and being more user-friendly and appealing than the Facebook metaverse, you actually get paid to interact with them. And so, you know, I'm just astounded that Facebook tried to develop their own when they should have learned from Instagram and WhatsApp. You don't develop your own stuff. You wait for somebody else to build something usable, and then you buy them.
Mm, yeah.
You as the big player, that's how you do it, because anything Facebook tries to do on their own is garbage.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the Disney model. Like, Disney could, I worked inside that beast for a few years, and it was just so lame. Now, that's before they realized, why are we trying to make new stuff? Just buy Star Wars, just buy Marvel, buy Harry Potter, buy everything. And genius. Bob Iger, brilliant.
Well, on the topic of cyclical history, are you familiar with the work of William Strauss and Neil Howe? The fourth turning and so that's very appealing to the boomer mindset. I think that gets a lot of traction. Are you familiar with it? I mean, on a level deep enough to have,
I think, commentary? If I remember correctly, there was going to be a generation who would be like the heroic ones, and that coincide with the baby boomers,
and they're supposed to be the millennials.
God help us. Yeah, I remember. I think Greer cast aspersions on that. I think he had good fun with that back in the Arch Druid report a long time ago.
So yeah. I'm going to Wikipedia and I'm putting in fourth turning. And so it's that directs me to the Strauss-Howe generational theory. And just to refresh everybody's memory, we've got four different recurring generational archetypes, which bring about four different so-called turnings, or, you know, historical periods. So you can start anywhere because it's a cyclical period, but we'll start with the first one, the high turning. According to Strauss and Howe, the first turning is a high, which occurs after a crisis. During the high, institutions are strong and individualism is weak. Society is confident about where it wants to go collectively, though those outside the majoritarian center often feel stifled by the conformity. Then comes an awakening. This is an era when institutions are attacked in the name of personal and spiritual autonomy. Just when society is reaching its high tide of public progress, people suddenly tire of social discipline and want to recapture a sense of self-awareness, spirituality, and personal authenticity. Young activists look back at the previous high as an era of cultural and spiritual poverty. After which comes the unraveling. The mood of this era, they say, is in many ways the opposite of a high. Institutions are weak and distrusted, while individualism is strong and flourishing. The authors say highs come after crises, when society wants to coalesce and build and avoid the death and destruction of the previous crisis. Unravelings come after awakenings, when society wants to atomize and enjoy. They say the most recent unraveling in the U.S. began in the 1980s and includes the long boom and the culture war. Then comes crisis, and I'm pretty sure we're at the beginning of crisis in their cycle right now. According to the authors, the fourth turning is a crisis. This is an era of destruction, often involving war and revolution, in which institutional life is destroyed and rebuilt in response to a perceived threat to the nation's survival. After the crisis, civic authority revives, cultural expression redirects towards community purpose, and people begin to locate themselves as members of a larger group. The authors say the previous fourth turning in the U.S. began with the Wall Street crash of 1929 and climaxed with the end of World War II. The GI generation, which they call the hero archetype, born 1901 to 1924, came of age during this era. They say their confidence, optimism, and collective outlook epitomize the mood of that era. The authors assert the millennial generation, which they describe as the hero archetype, born 1982 to 2004, show many similar traits to those of the GI youth, which they describe as including rising civic engagement, improving behavior, and collective confidence. So the four historical archetypes are the prophet generation. These are the idealists. This is the generation that enters childhood during a high, a time of rejuvenated conformity, life and consensus around a new societal order. Prophets grow up as the increasingly indulged children of this post-crisis era. So I think these are the boomers. Yeah. They come of age as self-absorbed young crusaders of an awakening, focus on morals and principles in midlife, and emerge as elders guiding another crisis. So the examples here are transcendental generation, missionary generation, and the baby boomers. Then comes the nomad generation. And this is my generation, Generation X. Nomad or reactive generations enter childhood during an awakening, a time of social ideals and spiritual agendas when young adults are passionately attacking the established institutional order. Nomads grow up as underprotected children during this awakening, come of age as alienated post-awakening young adults, become pragmatic midlife leaders during a crisis, and age into resilient post-crisis elders. Then come the millennials, and according to Strauss and Howe, they are the hero or civic generation. They enter childhood during an unraveling, a time of individual pragmatism, self-reliance, and laissez-faire. Heroes grow up as increasingly protected post-awakening children, come of age as team-oriented young optimists during a crisis, emerge as energetic, overly confident midlifers, and age into politically powerful elders, attacked by another awakening. So the last hero generation before the current was the GI generation, and then the millennials, or the current hero generation. And they are followed by the artist generation. Artist generations enter childhood during a crisis. So these would be the Gen Zers or the Zoomers, a time when great dangers cut down social and political complexity in favor of public consensus, aggressive institutions, and an ethic of personal sacrifice. Artists grow up overprotected by adults, preoccupied with the crisis, come of age as these socialized and conformist young adults of a post-crisis world, break out as process-oriented midlife leaders during an awakening, and age into thoughtful post-awakening elders. And the examples are the progressive generation, the silent generation, which is my parents' generation, and the Zoomers, which is my kids. So, you know, a lot of that really rings true to me, particularly, you know, I was saying that the Zoomers are largely reactions, you know, they're reacting or overreacting to the coddledness and the, you know, the whininess of the millennials. And that seems borne out in Strauss and Howe's description here. Well, so anyway, that's a lot of text that I just read, so I'll stop. And let you know.
My one issue with that is it seems very America-centric. And one of the amazing things about Sorokin and Spengler, kind of loop back into them, is he says that when you look at the different civilizations, he forget that they're separated in time. You can line them up like this, and you can see Alexander is Napoleon. You know, is the each culture has its like emergent historical figures, and we can map these onto one another. So he says this period of this culture corresponds to this period of this culture. And where Spengler's amazing is he'll put in like Chinese cultures. He's very knowledgeable across the entire breadth of the world. He's not supremacist about any of them. He says they're all equal. They're analogous to one another in these various forms of development. So for me, for like a theory like that to have explanatory power, you'd have to be able to apply it to other periods in history. It seems to be very America specific to try to explain the generational differences in the US. But speaking from my experience, say from Ireland, I don't know how that would apply to any of the generations in that country, because the processes were so different, being colonized as well, not having autonomy until relatively recently. So our generations would have been, I guess if we had a heroic generation, it was the revolutionary period and the Civil War in 1916. But again, it's more of what happened in that society is then they toppled the other ruling class and replaced them with their own children, who then become, in Spenglerian terms, like senile. They've led the country to ruinage at least twice in my lifetime. And how would you classify like an Irish? I'm Generation X, I guess. So insofar as I'm can be described as that, it's because of my exposure to American pop culture. But growing up in Ireland in 1969 or America in 1969, two very different experiences, they're going to produce very different people. And like the same with Russia, like if you had like a Russian person who's born in 69, again, a very different experience. Another thing Spengler said about cultures is that they each have a organizing idea or a motif that they tend to build their worldview around. And that kind of gives them like their scope of their development. And once they exhaust that, then they kind of sink away and a new organizing idea emerges. So he said that the organizing idea of the ancient classical culture was the human body, which to him was embodied in all the statues and the beautiful proportions of their buildings. He said that the Middle Eastern or Arab, what we call Arabic or Islamic cultures, was the cavern, the cave. And again, like there's no stained glass windows in mosques. They emerged in Europe. Their stained glass window was a form unique to what he called Faustian culture in the West, which is like this notion of verticality. And the organizing idea of the Russian mind, according to Spengler, is the infinite plane. So these worldviews, if he's correct, they do produce radically different people. And one thing that you get from Spengler and Sorokin and Carol Quigley and Toynbee as well, they all seem to be, and Danilevsky, he was an 1850 writer on collapse as well, with a cyclical theory. And was the idea that Russia is not thought of as a country, but a civilization. And you won't be helping yourself if you think that Russia is just this other country on the end side of Europe. It's not. It's a civilization in its own right.
And it's an ethnicity.
Yeah, and that's how it sees itself. And it's and if you've met Russians, and I have, and worked with them, they're different. I'm very fond of them, but my God, they are different people. They're not like, you know, you can relate with many things, but there's just this core, and you can feel it. You can just feel it. There's this like ball inside them that you don't get, and you probably never will. But
well, you met my previous girlfriend Olga.
Yes,
and she was born in the Soviet Union. You know, I lived with her for 5 years, so yeah, I certainly know the hard edge of the Russian, and particularly the Soviet Russian, and in her case, the Soviet Jewish Russian psyche.
Yes,
There's and her mother and her mother's friends, who were all, you know, Jews who escaped from the Soviet Union in the 1970s and came to the United States, they are the most hardcore Trump supporting, you know, socialism hating people you'll ever encounter.
Yeah.
And they're just cartoonishly so. I mean, just beyond, no nuance whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, Ronald Reagan is a god. Hmm. Donald Trump is the second coming. And yeah.
Yeah. Terry Eagleton is a British atheist writer, Marxist as well. And he wrote a book called Reason, Faith, and Revolution. And another one called Why Marx Is Right, which is also worth reading. But in Reason, Faith and Revolution, he describes how, because he's very connected with Ireland. And he said, because the Irish were given such an appalling version of Christianity, they buy their atheism on the cheap. And I feel the same way about Russians who turn their back on socialism. It's like you were given like a really, really horrible form of what should not have been a horrible thing. And it's easy then for you to reject it point blank because you were shown the worst possible iteration of it. If you're going to reject, and Eagleton says, if you're going to reject Catholicism or Christianity, that's fine, but reject the strongest form of it and not a, and not the worst.
What's that author's name?
Terry Eagleton.
Alrighty.
And those two books are really good. And he gives this most beautiful exegesis of Christianity and Catholicism. And then when you finish that, you go, oh, now I get it. That's why he did a better job of teaching me this, like Marxist atheist did a better job of teaching me about why Catholicism was a you know, positive view of the world than any priest or Christian brother ever did. You know, so whatever that tells you, I still don't believe it because I don't believe it.
It's interesting in that, you know, you obviously haven't heard this podcast interview because I haven't released it yet. But I talked to a guy named James Polis, and he wrote a book called Forever Human. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it is largely a criticism of and rejection of just the effects that information technology has had on our society and on our individual psychologies. And his solution is, you know, he is a theist, and he thinks that Christianity provides a very salutary basis, you know, for organizing a society because it values the individual, and it values the individual because, you know, humans have souls.
Yep.
And there, you know, there are certain ways that it is just unacceptable to degrade a human being if you take that as your basis, you know, your sort of metaphysical basis in life. Mm-hmm. And I agree. And at the same time, in my experience and in the world that I know, dead people who have been dead for 3 days don't come back to life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I get that there are certain benefits. I mean, I don't want to say certain benefits. There are enormous benefits to, you know, having this Christian ethic and this Christian worldview and organizing a society around it. And yet I just don't have it in me to literally believe that story.
Yeah.
So what do I do?
I
can't really champion it in good faith or present myself as a champion of it.
Well, that's the whole Nietzschean argument. You know, we have all these beautiful ideals and things, and they did come from Christianity. And now the Christian or the modern European wants to just say, oh, none of that actually happened, but we're going to keep all the stuff we like, but we're not going to have any
glass.
But we're not going to have to justify why our belief system makes even less sense now than it did before. Like people, I won't mention them, but people I know who think they've solved all the philosophical problems in the world because they now don't believe in God and they're rational. It's like, no, you haven't solved the philosophical problem. Now you've created a philosophical problem. And it's horrendous. Like, it's really fucking horrible because you've overthrown God. And that's fine if you want to do that. But Christ, would you just think about what this means? Like, no good, no evil. Like, oh, that, and then you go, oh, just because I don't believe in God, it doesn't mean that God can't be good. No, that's, you don't get it. It means that the word good doesn't mean anything. The word evil doesn't mean anything. Like this mouse, is this mouse good or evil? It's only made of molecules. It's just matter and motion in a void. And so are you. So I can do whatever I like. It's not, I'm not being evil. The word evil is just in your head. It's just relative.
For the listening audience, Dermot is holding up his computer mouse.
Yeah. And you would think that computer mouse isn't evil. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. There's a rose, like a blade of grass. You wouldn't call it good or evil. And so if there's no soul, if you're just molecules, you're not really... we've gotten to the point now where science is advocating eliminative materialism, I think is the word, which means we're not actually conscious at all. The consciousness is just an epiphenomenon, and we're just like these mindless meat robots, philosophical zombies. And, you know, again, no good, no evil. Do what you like. And you can be good, quote unquote, or bad, quote unquote. It doesn't mean anything. And this is where you go when you abolish metaphysics, when you say it's just matter, it's just materialism. And, you know, and you can't just wave that away. And people do, they just wave it away, and they just keep all the Judeo-Christian morality that was punched into them when they were kids. that's a sin, that's wrong, and that's that script's still running, but they just haven't pulled it apart.
That's an important point, because the person, like, I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church. I was raised Christian. And, you know, later I rejected the literal belief in the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And for a time in my late teens and early 20s, I was, you know, aggressively anti-theist and anti-religion, or at least anti-Christianity. But at the same time, you know, these later intellectual decisions that we make doesn't undo our upbringing. But then my kids, you know, were raised largely without any sort of religion, except, you know, my oldest son we were living in Arkansas where my mother lives, and she took him to Sunday school. And, you know, so he's got a basis of Christianity that his younger brother doesn't have. But the person who is raised with a particular faith, they don't have the option of, you know, rewriting their childhood. That stuff is laid down. Yeah, I think it was Thomas Aquinas who said, you know, give me the child to age five and I'll give you the man.
I think it was the Jesuits. I think it was the Jesuits.
Was it the Jesuits? But, yeah. You know, it's the principle of how you bring somebody into the world and how you orient them initially is going to stick regardless of what decisions they come to later.
Yep.
And so it's not the generation of people that, you know, rejects religion who lose its benefits. It's the generations that follow.
Yeah, and I grew up in a country that was very Catholic, and the good and the bad. Like, some of it was good, a lot of it was very bad.
Yeah, Robert Anton Wilson's got a whole book about just how awful Irish Catholicism was.
Yeah, no, some of those people should have been in prison cells, not teaching kids. Yeah. But on the other hand, like I had a dream a couple of years ago. Like, I deliberately thought, you know, I need to sort out all this stuff in my head. And you get weird dreams when you do that. And I had this dream where I was flying across a big blue lake to a convent, like something that sounded music, it sounds like. And the convent was full of nuns and they were all dressed in white. But there was a priest in the convent who was all in black. And then the nun told me that the priest was a vampire and he was going to kill them all or try to hurt them. And I was trying to figure out how to protect the nuns from the vampire priest. And I saw the priest pissing blood in a urinal, and he said, oh, no, I just had a bit too much wine. He tried to bullshit me, and I thought, fucking liar. And I woke up. I interpreted the dream fairly easily. That was my part of my Catholic unconscious are pure. It's female. They're dressed in white. And then there's the vampire priest. And it's my job to try to differentiate some of the psychic material from the other psychic material. And to basically be very, very careful when you're handling this, because some of this stuff is absolute fucking poison and some of it is very, very important. And if you just discard it all willy-nilly, or you act like you've abolished it, you have done nothing of the sort. They're still there. The vampire is still inside you. The nuns and the schoolgirls are still inside you. I am the vampire priest and I am the nuns. They're not separate from me. They are me. And it's the Jungian attitude about enlightenment. You make the darkness conscious.
Yeah, so you've got this toolkit of archetypes that you can use to make sense of the world. And if you reject Christianity entirely, then you're just throwing away this toolkit, this archetypal toolkit, which has been refined over a couple thousand years in favor of what?
Yeah. Some 20th century charlatan.
Exactly.
Or some academic who's never seen somebody murdered in front of his eyes, who doesn't really know what real evil looks like. And a lot of the stuff that's within Christianity is actually Neoplatonism via St. Augustine, or it's Aristotelian metaphysics via Aquinas. So you're not just throwing out the Holy Bible, you're also throwing out Aristotle and Plato. So you're playing a really dangerous game. And it's your people who do that kind of thing end up like the poor devil who ended up in Nexium. You know, he's been in two cults, the What the Bleep Do We Know cult, that Atlantean woman, and also Nexium. It's like, Jesus, dude, fool you once, you know. And I would tell anyone who's like a cult survivor, just go to your Penguin Classic shelf and read some fucking Plotinus or one of the Neoplatonists, because they're not trying to scam you. They're dead. Yeah. And they've been on that shelf for 2,000 years. They're not nothing, you know. It'll get your brain working, and you begin to see all the stuff that the charlatans steal. It's shameless. Like, they'll just steal all this stuff from Plato or Aristotle or any of the ancient classical philosophers, you know, more amenable. But yeah, then, and at least then you could, if you were to build your worldview around that Neoplatonism, you wouldn't go too far wrong. Like the idea that there is such a thing as a universal good, a universal evil. Either you know what they are, they have meaning. You're not living in an amoral void. You know, I much prefer that worldview or an animistic worldview than this kind of hellscape the moderns seem to be rushing into. One thing Spengler said was that when civilizations begin to decline, they enter a second religiosity. People begin to need to latch on to something spiritual, something meaningful to give their life purpose. But again, the problem with that in our society is it tends to be very chaotic and, you know, driven by memes now and all these cults. You know, like everybody else, my wife and I have been hooked on cult documentaries. We'll never pass one by. It's like, oh my God, there's another cult documentary on, you know, and it's just amazing to see the pattern. Like, it's like, talk about like a cyclical history again. They're all the same. You know, that beautiful golden dawn when you get everything's wonderful and then the initial doubts, but no, then they're cool. And always that point too, when they move, we got to move to a new compound. You know, we're being persecuted. So, oh, they're moving. They're fucked now. You know?
Yeah, and there was a period in my life when I fantasized about becoming a cult leader. So I studied it from a how-to perspective.
Yes,
yeah. I've outgrown the desire.
Yeah, good.
You know, I still understand, you know, the mechanics of it.
Yeah, it makes me squirm, like just bossing people around. It's like, ugh. No, I wouldn't like it. But yeah, I wouldn't mind having a nice big house though. That would be okay. Yeah. I guess that's how it starts.
We're heading up. You know, approaching an hour and a half here on the line. Let me change the subject entirely and ask you if you've seen the new Dune.
I haven't, and I'm waiting to see it in the theater. We're going to mask up. We're vaccinated, so we're going to wait until like a weekday. Mm-hmm. There's no way I'm looking at that on a small screen.
I watched it on HBO on Thursday night, and then I went on Friday night and saw it in the theater.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you can't really spoil the plot. I mean, the plot is 50 years old.
Yeah.
The novel was published in 1965. It's had two film adaptations already. So, you know, you don't have to worry about spoilers. But yeah, it's just gorgeous. It's so gorgeous.
Good.
And
good.
Finally, somebody got the ornithopters right.
Oh, okay. Third time lucky, because there was the awful Sci-Fi Channel Dune as well that we all forget about.
Yeah. Oh, I don't forget about it. I liked it. But, you know, I acknowledge its limitations. It was
TV budget 2005 or whatever that was.
Well, the first one was 2000 and then Children of Dune was 2003.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And, a lot of it looks like it's shot like the characters are in the desert, and the desert is just a cloth backdrop, you know, with the desert dunes painted on it.
Yes.
Very low budget, but it's because it's a miniseries and it's long. They get in a lot of the plot that had to be.
I wish
a lot of the plot had been sacrificed in the David Lynch version, but he went to the opposite extreme and tried to include everything in a 2.5 hour film and just, you know, squished this 500 page book into this tiny little space. And it was incoherent.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I'm looking forward to it. And it sounds like they've already greenlit the sequel. So that's good. Yeah.
Yes.
It's so great. Someone's done it right. That's fun.
It would be an absolute sin and tragedy for this film to exist without the second one, because it just ends. I mean, there's no ending to it. It just, that's like, whoop, 2.5 hours is gone. We're done.
Go home. See you in a year or two.
See you in 3 years or whatever.
Yeah.
If ever, you know, there's no guarantee. And because it opened on HBO the day before it opened in the theaters, I mean, that's crazy in terms of, you know, sabotaging the box office.
Yeah.
You know, how are they going to calculate really how much money the studio made?
Right.
And, you know, that's really important when it comes to deciding whether or not we get a sequel. And I think largely the studio decided to do a sequel just for the prestige, because this thing is so gorgeous. And it would just be a tragedy if it just ended in mid-sentence and, you know, they never finished it.
Yeah. Also, have you been watching Foundation? I never read the Asimov books. Yeah.
You know, it's very loosely based on the Asimov books.
I read
the Asimov books in the 80s and I haven't revisited them, and they're not cherished, you know, treasures to me. So I don't care if they take liberties with it. Mm-hmm. And I forget who I was talking to, but I said, Foundation is really lucky that it got like a month jump on Dune, because what Foundation has going for it is that it's gorgeous, but it's not as gorgeous as Dune.
Right.
you know. Right. So it got its moment in the sun. It got to prance on stage for a bit and say, "Hey, look at me! Look at how pretty I am!"
Yeah.
And then Dune comes along. It's like, "Oh, that's cute." Watch this.
Yeah. So you know, like offhand, how faithful it is, or how they've taken real liberties? Because I'm watching, like, I don't know, is this in the book?
With the Foundation books, there are these huge jumps forward in time where, you know, it's basically a series of novellas. It doesn't have any through character.
Okay.
You know, the major character in the beginning is Harry Seldon, the guy who comes up with the idea of psychohistory. But by the end of that first novella, he's dead, you know, of natural causes, as I recall.
Okay.
And then you're introduced to a new set of characters, you know, who are dealing with things hundreds of years later.
Right.
And then in the next chapter, it's hundreds of years later again, and you've got a new series of characters.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not doing that in the series. In the series, they want to have a consistent cast of characters.
Yeah.
So they're taking liberties around that. And, you know, you can do that in science fiction. You know, somebody's been in suspended animation for 30 years, and here's the actress looking just like she did 30 years ago. But, you know, the story has advanced by decades.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're doing that sort of thing. One fascinating thing they've done, like in the books, there's this empire that is in its high stage, you know, the end of its high stage, entering into its decline, which the psychohistory predicts. And the whole premise is that if Harry Seldon and his group get to go off and establish this foundation where they're going to create this Encyclopedia Galactica, where they encapsulate the best of the high civilization so that it can be reconstituted in 1,000 years instead of 10,000 years of dark age. They're keeping that, but in the books there was an emperor, but you don't see much of him. He's not really a big player. And in the series, they've come up with this neat conceit of a genetic dynasty where there are three emperors, Dawn, Day, and Dusk, and there are three clones of the same man at different ages. And the middle one is, you know, the real power. But then he graduates into the Dusk role, and the other Dusk, you know, walks into an incinerator basically and sacrifices himself. But it's the same guy, you know, ruling for 1,000 years until the current iteration where, you know, it's not working.
Right.
So I won't say anything more specific.
Yes. Yeah.
Have you seen it? Have you seen up to?
I have. Okay. Yeah.
So you know the not working. What I'm referring.
Yeah, I do. And I was very curious to wonder, like, just how accurate.
No, that's all invented for the series.
Oh, not okay. That's good to know. Okay.
Yeah. And also, they're having a robot assistant, you know, who's there for the long haul, is not in the book.
Continuity again. Okay, so they're Yeah, no, it reminds me of a couple of things, like A Canticle for Leibowitz by Miller, which is like a book that's amazing book, written in 1960, I think. And it's set in the future after there's an atomic war and World War III has wiped us out. And it's basically a retrace of the Dark Ages and then the Renaissance, and then the cycle begins all over again. And Miller had this very depressing, oh my God, very depressing worldview of this mad pendulum swinging deeper and deeper and deeper. But I won't say any more than that, but it's an amazing book. And
I've never read it, but the title is certainly familiar to me.
Yeah, no, it's after I finished it, I thought, holy shit, that was impressive.
Didn't read The Book of the New Sun by Gene Wolfe?
Yes, yeah, many years ago, though. I would have to reread it. I remember only that it's very... like at the end of the history of the world and everything's turned to crap. Yeah.
Well, basically this is thousands and thousands of years in the future, and anywhere, and most of the civilization has fallen into a very sort of primitive technological state like the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. But the main character, you can tell, who's an apprentice in the Guild of Torturers or the Seekers of Truth and Penitence, clearly he lives in a spaceship, but he doesn't know it's a spaceship and it's parked on Earth and it's not functional.
Yeah.
But, you know, anywhere that people dig, they're just digging up evidence of the long, long history of human civilization.
Yeah.
And some parts of it still enjoy high technology, and some parts of it are in touch with extraterrestrial civilizations.
Mm.
But for most people, life's pretty medieval.
Yeah.
And it's all... Wolf himself was, I think, just secular, rationalist, atheistic, until he got married, and his wife was devoutly Catholic, and he adopted her Catholicism with gusto.
Wow.
and everything in the Book of the New Sun, like all the characters are named after Catholic saints. And it's kind of like James Joyce, in that to really uncrack it, you have to go to some secondary materials. Mm-hmm. But once you get into those, you know, the Catholicism just leaps off the page.
Right. Yeah. We were up at the Irish pub about a year ago, and Kelly turned to me and she's talking about a passage in Ulysses where it refers to something like a banquet of uncouth stars or something. But uncouth stars is the operative phrase. And she had read a writer who he interpreted this to mean a reference to Giordano Bruno, the Renaissance magician. And Bruno wanted to redraw all the constellations so that they would, instead of being pagan gods raining down paganism on the world, we call them virtue and truth and beauty. And then these astrological magic would flow down from the constellation of truth and love and kindness. And hence the uncouth stars, Orion, Cassiopeia, were uncouth. And I reached into my bag and I pulled out France, which he didn't know I had. I pulled out the Francis Yates book, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition. And I said, it's mentioned in here. I tried to find it and I couldn't. I gave it to her. She eyesight's better than mine. It's that she found the reference, the page. Bruno wrote a book called The Spaccio. And in there, he talks about the uncouth stars. I mean, what was the fucking chances of that? Like, crazy. Mm-hmm. But again, it shows you the extent to which, yes, secondary material. I am intimately familiar with that process. Like, there is no way you could pick that apart. Kelly can't go to book readings anymore. She ruins them for people because everyone's just talking about it. Like, you cheer to the book. It should be fun. And she knows too much. You know, she can pull the entire sentence apart, like the Bitcoin Stevens on Sandy Mount Strand. It's complete stream of consciousness. She can pull the whole thing open and say, this is this, this is that, this is Berkeley, this is this, this is this. Yeah, and it all has meaning. There's nothing in there that's meaningless. But it seems like it's gibberish if a person is just like tumbling over the words. Yeah,
right. Well, just trying to read Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, forget just that.
Open the page and start reading it. It's like,
yeah. Yeah,
half these words are made up.
Yeah, like the thunder words. Yeah, yeah. We have a friend in Dublin who's Japanese, and he's Irish, half Japanese, and speaks Japanese, and he works in translations. And so we talked to him about the Japanese translation of Finnegan's Wake. We did a whole podcast interview with him about that, because they had to write like different kanji letters and make up completely new ones by combining.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. He said that it's a work of art in its own right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
With Book of the New Sun, when you read it, you know, just naively, it seems like it's full of made up words, and mm-hmm. it absolutely is not.
Yep.
There's not a single made up word in that book.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what one of the things Wolf is communicating is just how large a language English is and how little of it most of us know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's wild. Yeah. Like that. I remember reading that about Wolf. Somebody said that it's a philological like roller coaster. Yeah. You have to know your Greek and your Latin.
Yeah, it's easier now that, you know, you have the internet, but when I was in high school, I had an unabridged dictionary, and it's a big unwieldy thing, you know, but yeah. Reading the Book of the New Sun, actually, when I read Book of the New Sun, it was the 90s and I had internet access. So I was looking up words that way. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to go to the enormous, you know, you stun an ox with it dictionary.
Yes. Well, by the way, like we're talking about foundation too. I kind of slipped my head. Like, I think it seems to me that I probably just looked this up. It seems to me like it's an analog to that kind of attempt to save what is being lost that actually happened. There's Boethius, the late Roman, they call him the last of the true Romans. He was born in 476, so the year after the nominal fall of the empire, or around the same time. And he only lived to be 47. But he realized that all of the classics were in Greek, and the educated Roman class were forgetting their Greek, and so they were losing all their access to you know, the great corpus of knowledge. And so he took it upon himself to translate as much of it as he could from Greek into Latin. So he got a bunch of treat like Aristotle and other, I forget now the other fragments that he got, but insofar as he translated anything from Greek into Latin, that was preserved. He ended up being executed. It makes you wonder if he'd lived longer, like he died too soon. But the few translations that he did were preserved by Cassiodorus in monasteries by Christian monks. And all this is what gets me about the new atheist bashing of Christians. Like the reason why you have so much that survived is because Christian monks preserved so mm-hmm. much of this material at great expense and cost and time. And they weren't copying these for fun. or just to exercise their handwriting. They knew this was important. This was important material. Like natural philosophy was the handmaid of theology in the Christian tradition, was to be respected. And the pagan Greek philosophers were seen as precursors sent by God to prepare the way for Christ. So this became the body of the medieval curriculum of the quadrivium and the trivium, seven liberal arts. And so that when I'm watching the foundation, that's what all the attempt to do a deliberate, a much more a controlled version of that with more backing, more power. Like it's a what might have been. If Boethius had been given like a couple of scribes, it's such a tiny thing, you know, but just a couple of people to help with the translation. It wouldn't have taken much. And that sliver of what he preserved would have expanded to something. And then that would have been a larger seed that would have helped the early medievals, but did not happen. So they have to wait until the 11th and 12th centuries. So, yeah, it's like another couple of hundred years of struggle. You know,
an interesting thing about Foundation and Dune basically appearing on screen at the same time now is that Foundation, you know, Asimov started those books, I don't know the exact year, it was certainly, you know, the first half of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And he was not really, at the time, it was not bad to be an empire, you know?
Yeah.
So having this galactic empire, it wasn't, you know, the empire of George Lucas. It wasn't, you know, the Imperial March and whatnot. It was, you know, this was a successful civilization. Mm-hmm. That's the form successful civilizations took. And then Dune was written, or it was published in 1965. So basically, you know, Frank Herbert was a generation later. Mm-hmm. And he was commenting on, you know, the unquestioned value of empire, you know, that Asimov just took for granted. But, you know, Asimov had this very long career, and he continued, you know, he had his robot novels, and he had the Foundation novels, and he had different series of novels that at the end of his career, he was stitching them all together. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he was like, long after people had been commenting on his own work for decades, he's still refining it as he's writing these later books. And then, you know, Dune comes out in 65. It is a massive success and cultural inspiration. George Lucas borrowed liberally, to put it politely, from Dune, you know, to give us Star Wars. But, you know, Star Wars is from my childhood and yours. So that's that's our entry point into this whole process. And now here we are, many, many decades later, and Foundation and Dune are coming out, you know, these new versions of it are coming out together. Mm-hmm. And yet these are two things that sort of grew in reaction to one another.
Right.
You know, and you can't see that on screen right now. If you just come in and you're just looking at the plot and the characters and whatnot, the history of it and the history of the sort of dynamic tension between them is not apparent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it sounds like there's been enough changes made to Foundation. I'd probably have to read the books. I've never read them, so
I wouldn't bother, actually.
You wouldn't? Oh, okay.
I mean, they're classics, but in terms of enjoying the series and appreciating the series, it's not necessary, really.
Okay.
And in fact, I remember when I saw the David Lynch version of Dune in 1984, I saw it in the theater. I waited until after I had finished the book to go see it. So I had just finished the book like the day before, and I hated it. I love the book. I hated the film.
Yeah.
Because it was so, so at odds with what I had in my head. And it was what I had in my head was fresh.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've come to appreciate David Lynch's Dune over the decades.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it's from the 80s, I'm nostalgic for it.
Yes. Yeah.
But it, you know, in terms of a faithful adaptation of the material.
Yeah.
In some ways it's too faithful, but in other ways it's deliberately ugly.
Yeah.
And, you know, Frank Herbert, that's not what he was presenting on page. And that really just distracts from the themes, I think. Hmm. You don't have to have boils all over Vladimir Harkonnen's face to communicate that he's evil. I mean, his actions are evil.
Yeah, that was gross. To say, I love that physical grossness. Yeah, that was disgusting. Yeah.
It's very David Lynch. I mean, you know, he was closer to the Elephant Man and Eraserhead at that point in his career than he was to, like, you know, Wild at Heart or Mulholland Drive.
Right.
You know, he was coming from this basement grotesquery, low budget aesthetic. And somehow he was given, you know, this enormous prestige project to direct.
It's a crazy casting choice, really. Yeah.
A great cast in that first one, though.
It was. I love the look of it. Like the cast, the actors themselves. Yeah,
like Max von Sydow and Jürgen Prochnow. And, you know, that's where we got to meet for the first time. What's his name? McLaughlin, Kyle McLaughlin.
Kyle McLaughlin, yeah.
Who went on to do Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And Showgirls.
Showgirls. Oh, God.
Anyway, we've been on for a long time, and now it's really degenerated into random associates. Dermot, it is always fun to talk to you. You read books, which makes you interesting.
I recommend it. It's really good.
So, best of luck with your move.
Yeah, it's going to be a few months of extreme stress. It's going to be $3,000 to get our stuff shipped over there, and we don't have that much. It's a 10 by 10 by 10 square foot pod, so... But we'll squeeze it all in. Yeah.
I have a new bucket list item. Visit Dermot in Ireland.
Oh, please do. Yeah, no, once we get set up, chances are we'll be probably a bit bored if we're like out in the boonies. So we've told everybody, like everybody that we know, we have an open invite. We're trying, hopefully we'll have a place with a guest room. So, you know, because one thing that'll save a lot of money on a trip to Ireland, it's not the flight. You can get flights for diddly squat. Like flights are nothing. It's the Airbnbs and the hotels and the accommodation when you're there that'll drain your money, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and shorten your stay, because, you know.
Yeah, and you want to be
afford to pay $100 a night to live.
No, that adds up. Yeah, no, you want to have at least 3 weeks, I would think, to, you know, a week for Dublin, more than enough. But then the rest of your time scouting around, driving around the place, rental car, even like trains and buses, you could see a lot. You know?
Yeah, well, I'll have relatives there. I mean, I already do, but I don't know them. So hopefully that will, you know, having friends and relatives in a place certainly gives you a better insight into it than just showing up.
Yeah. You should make inquiries with the consulate in San Francisco. I think there's an Irish embassy and I presume there was in New York too, about qualifying for citizenship. There's basically one Irish grandparent. I'm fairly sure it's a shoo-in.
Yeah.
And then I think your kids can inherit that too. So
that would be good.
Because then you're an Irish citizen, so then they can get it. So I always tell people you can't have enough passports.
And Ireland is still an EU member, so...
Yep, and you'd have...
That opens up the entire European Union.
And it actually opens up the UK even after Brexit, because we're in the common travel area with them. So that's not affected either, so...
Well, being a US citizen gives you ready access to England anyway.
Yeah, but in terms of like living and working, it would really ease the path too.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Yeah, you'd be able to go and vote, probably, I would think. Yeah. No, they still think we're in the UK. Never told them, you know.
I wouldn't presume to vote anywhere but the US, really. Anyway, Dermot, always good to talk to you.
All right.
Talk to you again soon, I hope.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Dermot O'Connor, and I probably could have cut that conversation off like 15 minutes ago. It got pretty unstructured there at the end. And, you know, the neat thing about a podcast is like if this were a YouTube video and I put unstructured, just sort of chit chat at the end and people who were there, you know, just for the content and then they wanted out, the YouTube algorithms would punish me for people dropping out early. And in podcasting, there is no such hall monitor. You know, there is no such referee standing there with a clipboard and a stopwatch and a whistle and, you know, ready to give out demerits. Podcasting is one of the early forms of one-to-many communication that was available to everybody, you know, without any sort of corporate backers or expensive equipment or anything like that. You know, it was one of the early forms of getting your voice out there. I mean, your literal voice out there on the internet. And as such, it existed pretty much in its current form before the rise of the algorithmic monitors and sensors and, you know, success coaches or whatever. And it's still pretty free, particularly this sort of podcast, which is created for a pretty small audience and sits behind a paywall. Freedom. All right. You're a good audience. I won't blow smoke into your orifice any further. I will talk to you later. As happens so very infrequently with the Sea Realm Vault podcast, I've already got the next one recorded. It's with Bob Brown. It's about COVID. It's a long one. But it's in the can. Nothing in it is time sensitive, though, so I'm going to let it sit for a little while. and turn my attention to visual art for a couple days. And then when I get back into podcasting mode, I will get that out to you. Alrighty. Y'all are great. Talk to you soon.